From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Ahead of Super Tuesday, why Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says she is in the race for the long haul.
The way I see it is I'm out there running to get enough delegates to be able to win the convention. That's exactly what I'm working on.
Former Secretary of State in Massachusetts Senator John Kerry on why he's supporting Joe Biden and why he thinks it's time to shrink the field.
Donald Trump loves the fact we have a circular firing squad. He's raising money by the gazillions, and we need to focus on the real task at hand, which is to change the direction of our country and of the world.
We also delve into what America's black vote means for candidates in 2020.
When you talk about the backbone of the Democratic Party, you're talking about black people, especially black women. But there has to be a way to really bring them into the process beyond just wanting their vote.
We'll take your calls next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar has dropped out of the U.S. presidential race. She will endorse Vice President Joe Biden later today. That leaves five Democrats in the race, including Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Now, Massachusetts is one of 14 states and one U.S. territory that are going to go to the polls tomorrow, Super Tuesday. Senator Warren is going to vote in Cambridge tomorrow, but she won't be here to watch the results roll in tomorrow night. She'll be in Detroit, Michigan, not a Super Tuesday state. Just before the news about Klobuchar broke, WBUR's Bob Oakes spoke with Senator Elizabeth Warren about the future of her campaign.
Let me ask you, kind of frankly, you've been running third, fourth, and in fifth place in the early primary states, yet you vowed to take your campaign all the way to the convention. Why, when there's no indication at this moment that you're going to break that pattern?
The way I see it is I'm out there running to get enough delegates to be able to win the convention. That's exactly what I'm working on. I have more than a million individual contributors to my campaign. During the month of February alone, we raised $29 million. People are in this fight because I made the decision from the very beginning not to do fundraising by going to spend time with billionaires and corporate executives and lobbyists. I ended up going to 30 states and Puerto Rico, and I've built out operations in all of those places. I always assumed this was going to be a long primary, and we have a lot of people who are in it. And I'm doing my best to try to be the one who's got enough delegates by the time we get to the convention to win.
Well, explain what your path to the nomination is, if you would, because a lot of Democrats, and I think you know this, a lot of Democrats can't see it.
The way I see it, it's now clear. The Democratic Party is a progressive party, and progressive ideas are popular. So that's part one. I am a progressive and I fight for progressive ideas. And the second part is, as a party, we're only going to get one chance here to make real change, to get the things through like universal child care and canceling student loan debt and increasing Social Security payments. So we need a nominee and we need a president who has a track record for getting things done. That's the kind of work I did when I built the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's the kind of work I've done on hearing aids. It's the kind of hard work I've done pretty much all my life, but this time really focused on how we get legislative change made. And I have a track record for that, so that's my pitch to the voters.
You know, you say the Democratic Party is a progressive party. Certainly Joe Biden is hoping that it's more of a centrist party. But given the voting so far, progressives seem to be coalescing around Bernie Sanders. Is your message to voters somehow getting lost in translation?
I don't know. I'm not there to talk about message. I'm there just to talk about the ideas and to get out what it is that we have such an incredible opportunity to do in 2020. You know, we have to beat Donald Trump. You bet we do. But we also have to deliver real change starting in January 2021. And that's going to take knowing which fights to take on, how to fight them smart, how to build coalitions, you know, back during the financial crisis a decade ago, when I had the idea for Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, people told me, great idea, but don't even try because you can never get something like that passed. It's just too progressive. You can't get it done. But I dug in on it. I fought the banks. They were spending more than $1 million a day at one point to fight us. I fought Wall Street. I built the coalitions. And Barack Obama signed that agency into law and proved we fight smart, we fight right, we can get things done. We can make government work for the people.
You know, Senator, I think I've heard you say that story maybe a dozen or two dozen or three dozen times during the course of this campaign. And while I appreciate it, I'm just not so sure it's cutting through with voters.
Well, you know, I think it's an important part of understanding where we head next. We need a nominee who speaks to all parts of the Democratic Party, and we need a nominee who can get the job done.
And is that not Bernie Sanders? Do you not see Bernie Sanders being able to do that, or Joe Biden?
We both wanted, both Bernie and I, wanted to rein in Wall Street following the crash of 2008. I'm the one who dug in and did the hard work and delivered on it. That was what I did. And it has made a big difference. People aren't getting cheated on mortgages and credit cards in the way they were before that agency came along. We need to be smart going forward. Progressive ideas are what have captured the imagination of this country. People understand that we can't just have the same old, but we're really going to have to deliver come January 2021.
Just so I can translate here, is Joe Biden the same old?
Joe Biden is not the person who is talking about new ideas. He's not talking about big changes. He's talking about modest changes. And look, modest changes would be better than where we are now. Everyone standing on that Democratic stage would make a better president than Donald Trump and would take us in a better direction. And I support whoever our Democratic nominee will turns out to be. But I do believe this is a moment we've been called to in history, not just to get rid of Donald Trump, but a moment when we have enough people off the sidelines, enough people fighting back against the influence of money in Washington, enough people who say, you know what? It is time. It's time for universal child care. It's time to cancel student loan debt for 43 million Americans. It's time for universal health care coverage. It's time to expand Social Security. We make just those four changes, and that's life transformative for tens of millions of people all across this country. It's an exciting moment.
Are you worried that a long fight all the way to the convention this summer would weaken the party heading into the election, the fight against Donald Trump, as you say?
Look, I want to see us come together as a party. I think it's going to be important to unite behind a candidate who speaks to all parts of the party and who works with all parts of the party. I do believe that's going to be important because our number one job come November is to beat Donald Trump. And it's going to take a unified party to do that. And the sooner we get there, the better. We cannot have a repeat of 2016.
Well, one last question, if I might. In Massachusetts, the polls show a very tight race, but with Sanders ahead of you, tell me one place you're going to win tomorrow on Super Tuesday or in the coming weeks.
You know, I think of this as 10 years ago, I wasn't even in politics. 10 years ago, I was still a college professor. And when people said that Scott Brown was going to be reelected no matter what, and some people encouraged me to run for the Senate, and I threw it out there and said, I will do my best. I got in that race, and people all across Massachusetts, some with long histories in politics, but people I didn't know, and some who'd never been in politics before, said, you pick that up and do that, and we'll help you out. I will always be grateful to the people of Massachusetts for putting me in this fight, and I hope I've done a good job of fighting it on their behalf.
But with all due respect, Senator, you didn't answer the question. Uh, you, You did win in Massachusetts. Where are you going to win in the presidential contest?
Look, what I'm doing is I'm out there fighting for every vote. This is about winning. Today, we talk about universal child care. A year ago, we didn't. And we talk about it as a reality. I'm shown how we could do that. A 2-cent wealth tax, and we can have universal child care in this country. A 2-cent wealth tax, and we can cancel student loan debt. Increase the taxes on the top 2% of Americans, and we can actually increase both Social Security and disability payments for everybody in this country by $200 a month. Those are life transformative changes. And today, they look like a reality. They are possible. They are within our grasp. We just have to reach out there and take them. And to me, that's winning.
And that's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking with WBUR's Bob Oakes a little earlier this afternoon. Now, from a current Massachusetts senator to a former one, John Kerry. Kerry is also a former Secretary of State, and he joined us this afternoon minutes before Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar dropped out of the race to explain why he is endorsing former Vice President Joe Biden, even with a senator from his home state still in the race.
Look, I think Elizabeth's a terrific senator, and I think she's been a great warrior in this, and she's clearly been extraordinarily articulate. And I'm a fan of Elizabeth's, but I think we are at a particular moment in our country where our democracy is threatened in ways that will require a very special set of relationships and a readiness, if you will, to pull people together. Joe Biden has shown that capacity many, many times in many different ways. I mean, when Obama came in and we had the crisis of our economy, it was Joe Biden that he made in charge of getting on the Hill to get the Recovery Act passed, that we did. And it was the largest infrastructure program and last one we've had in our country, but the largest in history. I think the world is broken right now. We have the Iran nuclear agreement in tatters and near war. We have nuclear weapons challenges around the world. We have cyber challenges. We have Russia, China doing various things. Joe Biden has been there, done that. He's got the readiness, I believe. He doesn't have to build a relationship with the leader of another country. You also have another asset. Joe Biden is the only candidate running who was asked to campaign in 24 states for 65 candidates in 2018 when we won back the House. And those congressmen and people, men and women who were elected, will tell you that they're afraid of running down the ticket with other candidates.
So let's pick that up for a minute. You've said in previous interviews and talking about Joe Biden, the vice president, that he is a powerful progressive. So first, would you agree that he is more moderate than Senator Sanders or Elizabeth Warren? Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly more moderate than Senator Sanders. You know, Joe Biden is not a socialist, and he's not proposing Medicare for all because we can't afford it, number one, and number two, you can't pass it. And number three, it kicks 150 million Americans off of their insurance. So I don't think you can get elected to that. I think in Michigan, which I had the privilege of carrying when I ran for president, is not a state that can be carried if you've been flirting with or are supportive of Medicare for All, because most of the auto workers there joined the union to have their health insurance. And they're not going to want to be told, you're off it. You can't have it anymore.
So to that point, what does it then mean to be progressive in 2020? You've just listed a range of states that need to be carried, a coalition that needs to be built. So what does it need to mean?
Well, I think it's progressive to say, it is progressive as you get to say that you're going to expand Obamacare, provide everybody in the nation a choice, not kick them off, but give them a choice. Do you want a public option? Do you want to do the Obamacare? That's a choice, and that works. And that's something that gets by. So Joe Biden is progressive. He wants everybody in America to have health insurance. He fought to pass Obamacare. That's the most progressive accomplishment we've had in the health field since Harry Truman started trying to pass health care.
Why do you think Vice President Biden outperformed the polls in South Carolina on Saturday?
Because I think people are suddenly taking stock of the choice in the party, which, you know, with all due respect to a number of people who are currently still running, I think if you read today's New York Times, made it pretty clear that it's becoming a choice between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And I think a lot of people are motivated and deeply concerned about Bernie Sanders candidacy for president. I've seen what's happened to us previously when we have somebody who can be fringed. That doesn't mean they are a fringe. I was fringed. I've been there. I know what it means when you get attacked for things you didn't do or your record or perceptions. And I think Joe Biden from Scranton, Pennsylvania, a kid whose dad had to move to Delaware to find a job, who sat around the kitchen table and worried about where the ends were going to meet, is a guy who can appeal to people in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and places we need to win. So I just think, you know, we've really got to be hard-nosed about this. If I were just voting on one issue or another, then I might, you know, say, okay, I like this person because they're really good and strong on that one issue. We don't have the luxury of one issue this year.
A moment ago, you said that this is becoming a choice between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. If there is a contested convention, do you think that the candidate with the most delegates going into the convention should get the nomination?
Of course not. That's not the rules.
Why not?
That's just not the rules. Because the rules are the rules that Bernie Sanders wrote. Bernie Sanders was the principal architect of the change in the rules. And last time he ran, he argued that it shouldn't be the person with the most votes. Then now all of a sudden he's flipped on the rules he tried to pass. He did pass. It's 50% plus one person. That's democracy. And that's exactly the rules that Bernie wrote. And those are the rules that they ought to live by. And that's exactly the way that has worked historically.
Let's look past the convention for a moment. Let's look at a scenario where, after the convention, Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee. We had a WBUR poll last Friday that showed that Bernie Sanders supporters are the least committed to supporting some other Democratic nominee. So should Biden become the nominee, what does he need to do to bring Sanders supporters along and other supporters along into the general election?
Well, he needs to work hard, obviously, and all of us need to work hard, and I will work hard. I'll work for anybody who's the nominee, whoever wins, to make the powerful argument that we cannot afford anybody to sit out. Just take the issue of climate change alone. That issue is the existential threat to all of us. We're going to need amazing leadership, and we're going to need a country that votes on that issue this year.
Secretary Kerry, just one last question for you. Pete Buttigieg and Tom Steyer both dropped out after South Carolina. Do you think other candidates who have been struggling to get traction should drop out as well for the good of the Democratic Party?
I think that Elizabeth Warren's memo from Roger Lau, who I know and love and respect, he's one of the great patriots of working in campaigns and helping make things better. He wrote a memo in which he said there's no path at this moment that says that his candidate or some of the other candidates are going to have any way to become the nominee except at a brokered convention. So I believe that's where we're headed, probably. I do think that at this point in time, because of that, they ought to give the best shot to those people who are in a position at this point to represent different points of view within the Democratic Party. That's a hard thing to say, but I think, you know, we've reached a point now where there have been four different primaries and caucuses. Tomorrow, there's a massive day, and that will put a lot on the handwriting on the wall, and people certainly have a right to go through tomorrow and make a judgment. But I think after that, we need to get down to the business of finding a nominee. Donald Trump loves the fact we have a circular firing squad. He's raising money by the gazillions, and we need to get our party squared away here to begin to focus on the real task at hand, which is to change the direction of our country and of the world.
That's former Secretary of State John Kerry. Secretary Kerry, I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And we reached out to Senator Bernie Sanders today to appear on the show, but the senator was unable to join us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Voters in 14 states, including Massachusetts and one U.S. territory, go to the polls for the presidential primaries tomorrow, Super Tuesday. In the highly contested Democratic primary, a massive haul of delegates is up for grabs, 1,357 of the required 1,991 needed to clinch the nomination. Before the break, we heard from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren herself on her final push. And on behalf of former Vice President Joe Biden, we heard from the former Secretary of State, John Kerry. Listening in to both of those conversations was WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, and he joins us now. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Tiziana.
So what stood out to you?
Well, a couple of things. I thought Bob Oakes did a good job with Elizabeth Warren asking some key questions. You know, chief among them, can she win anywhere tomorrow? That said, you know, we heard her make the point that she's raised close to $30 million in February. Only Bernie Sanders has raised more than that. So she wants to push on. And with that kind of bankroll, she can do that. Can she push all the way to the convention, though, in Milwaukee? I mean, that's not clear to me. But look, if your account is flush with cash and you've got more than a million folks who have donated and the race is being shaken up almost hourly, right? I mean, Steyer's out, Buttigieg is out, Klobuchar is out.
Bam, bam,
bam. Bam, bam, bam. It's a different race all of a sudden just in the last few hours.
But to be clear, Anthony, you're not saying that you think there are any states she's going to carry tomorrow.
No, I don't think, I mean, she couldn't answer that question. That's my point. She couldn't answer that question that Bob asked her. I don't think there are any states that she can carry tomorrow, including Massachusetts, which looks doubtful. I'm not saying she can't carry Massachusetts. I'm saying it's not certain.
And I interrupted you in my curiosity before you got to the John Kerry part. So let me let you do that.
No, that was it. That was sort of what stood out to me. I mean, I was just really struck by this is a difficult question for Warren to answer. On the other hand, she has the means to carry on at least for a while longer. And so that's what she's going to do.
OK, as you noted, rapid fire changes. Amy Klobuchar out today. Pete Buttigieg dropped out last night. Tom Steyer earlier than Buttigieg. Biden took South Carolina, and Bernie Sanders was here in Massachusetts twice, and that's Warren's home state. So let's start with Sanders. How is he looking in your mind going into tomorrow?
Well, he's looking very strong. I mean, particularly in the biggest prizes of the day, Texas and California. We can talk about California. There was a new Suffolk University USA Today poll that shows that Sanders could capture the lion's share of the convention delegates out of California. He was like at something like 35% among likely Democratic primary voters, well ahead of Mike Bloomberg. Biden was at 14. Warren was at 12%. So he's going to do very, very well. Biden will probably do well, particularly across those states in the South where the African-American vote will feature in a big way.
So, Anthony, a few times on our show in the last few months, you've raised concerns by Sanders or Sanders supporters that the Democratic establishment is working against him, essentially. Do you think that Democratic establishment would allow Sanders to clinch the nomination?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by the Democratic establishment. I mean, as we heard John Kerry say, there are rules that will decide who the nominee is. And if we get to the convention and nobody has a majority of delegates, then it's going to be a brokered convention. And Sanders might have a tough job consolidating a majority of delegates around him. Now, his backers, you know, want to claim that if he's got a plurality of delegates, he should get the nomination. But I think Kerry is correct. Under the rules, which Sanders had a hand in writing, the nomination goes to the candidate with a majority of delegates. And if there is a brokered convention, there's no guarantee that that will be Sanders.
Okay, so it seems like we've got these lanes settling, Sanders dominating the progressive lane. Biden seems to be staking a claim to the moderate lane, you know, endorsed by now CNN is saying both Klobuchar and Buttigieg later today.
Right.
Okay, but there's this guy, Michael Bloomberg, out there.
This guy, Michael Bloomberg.
So let's talk about him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because he's still in the race, obviously, and his rationale...
He's sort of not yet in the race, right?
Yeah, right. It's starting officially with Super Tuesday. But his rationale for getting in the race was to offer a moderate alternative because it appeared that Biden was going down. But Biden demonstrated that he's alive and well after South Carolina. He's picked up a bunch of endorsements, as you just mentioned, especially with Buttigieg and Klobuchar out. So, you know, now the main person standing in his way is Bloomberg. So I guess my question about that is what will be the effect, and we'll find out tomorrow, of all of these millions that he's spent? on these Super Tuesday states. And an interesting case study about this is Tom Steyer. You know, he tried to buy victory in South Carolina. He spent close to $200 million just on advertising across the country. He barely registered in South Carolina. So maybe money isn't everything. Maybe Bloomberg will learn the same thing tomorrow. It'll be interesting to see.
All right. We mentioned at the top of the hour that, in fact, as polls roll in tomorrow night, Elizabeth Warren won't be here in Massachusetts. She'll be in Detroit. You're going to be with her. I know you're going to join us from Detroit Live tomorrow. What does it mean that she's going to be in Michigan on the night of Super Tuesday?
Right. Well, I mean, look at it this way. Bernie Sanders is going to be in Vermont tomorrow. That's his home state. He's going to be celebrating not only a win in his home state, he'll probably be celebrating at least a couple of other wins across the country. And you heard Bob Oakes pressing Warren, you know, where can she win tomorrow? So rather than have an evening in a state where you lose, she's spending the evening in an important state, Michigan, that votes next week. And so I think that's the answer. I mean, she doesn't want to be standing in a state that she loses. And she needs to look ahead and keep pressing this point that this race continues. Roger Lauer, campaign director, makes the point that she can continue to pick up delegates after Super Tuesday. And that's what she intends to do. But again, the way this race is unfolding and changing and evolving by the hour, who knows what we're going to be talking about 24 hours, or let's say 36 hours from now.
All right. So in all fairness, you did just talk about looking ahead. We've mostly talked about tomorrow. I know it's really unpredictable, but is there anything you're going to be looking for on Wednesday, the day after?
Well, I mean, I guess the day after and the days after, you know, after being given up for dead, Biden came back in South Carolina, but that's just one win. So my big question going forward is, can he build on that and really become a credible moderate alternative to Sanders? That's a huge question. We've also been talking a lot about Elizabeth Warren. You know, can she really pursue this path all the way to the convention, picking up delegates without actually winning? That's another huge question. So those are a couple of themes I'll be watching.
Well, we look forward to watching it with you. That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Thanks, Anthony.
My pleasure.
And hey, stay with us. Coming up, we are going to talk about the role of Black voters in 2020. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Black voters put Vice President Joe Biden's presidential campaign back on the map on Saturday, where he garnered nearly 50% of the state's vote. In fact, one out of every four Democratic primary voters is expected to be a Black voter in 2020, a year in which the candidate pool started with record-breaking numbers of people of color and is now, again, all white. Today, we want to delve into the Black vote in America. What does it mean for the candidates in 2020 and for essential issues of this general election? Here in Studio 3 to help us do that is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the national NAACP's board of directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Glad to be here.
Also with us on the line is Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor Renee Graham. Renee, welcome back to you, too.
Good to hear you, Tiziana.
And just a quick disclosure, the Boston Globe has endorsed Senator Elizabeth Warren. So pull up a chair. If you are a Black voter, what's important to you in this election? Do any candidates stand out for you? And if you're not a Black voter, there's no question that this part of the electorate is important. So what should the Democratic Party make of there being no candidates of color left in the race? What are the deeper long-term commitments that the party needs to make to represent core issues important to the diversity of Black voters in America? Please join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Michael, I'm going to start with you in general. How would you describe the role of Black voters in this 2020 race?
Yeah, I think, one, it's always it's a good place to start to put the disclaimer out that Black voters are not monolithic. We have some recurring themes that we look for in candidates. But if you are in Alabama or North Carolina or Boston, those issues may vary. So I think that's one. Two, there are some commonality among Black voters across the country. We care about criminal justice issues. And as we've seen play out on our television, whether it's mass incarceration or police-involved shootings, we want a criminal justice system that is acknowledging that Black Lives Matter. And the Obama administration began that work, and it's been turned around under the Trump administration. So I think we're looking for education, we're looking for housing, we're looking for a health care system that is treating us and giving us primary care providers. And most importantly, Black voters want to know that we will remove this Trump, this president, from the White House. And I think, quite frankly, as I talk to people across the country, that's the primary driver for Black voters.
So, Renee, you were in South Carolina over the weekend, which gives you a really, you know, current take. Joe Biden won the support of black voters there. What was it like, and how does that illustrate the points Michael's just making?
I think what I found really interesting when I was down in Charleston was, you know, going into South Carolina, the media created this narrative that, you know, South Carolina's was Joe Biden's for the taking. They've been saying this for months. Then they kind of forgot about it after New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada. And so they acted really surprised when Joe Biden won. When I was talking to people down there, almost every single person I talked to, regardless of generation, was backing Joe Biden. And they were doing that because they believed he was the person who was best equipped to beat Donald Trump. And all they really talked about was beating Donald Trump.
And why did they think that Biden was the person best equipped to do that, Renee?
You know, I think a lot of the people I talked to described themselves as progressive and said that there were candidates that they also liked, that they liked Bernie Sanders and that they liked Elizabeth Warren. But they also don't trust white Americans to back a progressive agenda and to back a progressive candidate. So they're going, you know, it's a very pragmatic choice what the voters I spoke to were making. You know, it's not that they have anything against Warren or Sanders. They're just not sure that that's the direction America is willing to go in, even though a progressive agenda would very much help people of color in this country.
It is similar to what we've heard when people have said, I'm ready for a woman president, but I'm not going to vote for one because I don't think my neighbor would vote for a woman president, Michael.
Absolutely. I think, you know, African-American voters, women voters, people of color are aspirational. And when they talk about Medicare for All or free college education, or you go down the list, they would benefit. Communities of color would benefit from that. But winning is important, too. So as was said, people are practical, and there are also conservative voters within the Democratic Party. People can be very centrist, as Clyburn pointed out when he talked about North Carolina, South Carolina. When you take all of that into account, people want to know that whoever the nominee is can win. And you think about whether it's a liberal progressive who has these ideas that can't deliver Congress, because you can win the White House. But can you bring Congress along, and are you persuasive enough? Will we have the seats in the House and Senate to deliver on all the aspirational stuff that you've brought us to the table to achieve? I think black voters are questioning that.
So join the conversation. What is the profile of the candidate that can, you know, quote unquote, can win for the Democratic Party in this year's presidential election? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Renee, put the relationship between black voters and the Democratic Party into a little bit of historical context for us, if you would, please.
I mean, if you kind of look at that relationship, say, for the last half century, when, you know, the Southern Strategy comes into effect in 1968 with Richard Nixon, and essentially that the Democrats sort of lose regions of the country because of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So there's been this idea that you know, blacks are the stalwarts of the Democratic Party. The problem with that is because they generally will not vote Republican, Democratic candidates tend to take the black vote. And I say black vote in quotes because, as Michael mentioned, it's not a monolith.
Right.
But they take the black vote for granted. And so there's a sense that, well, we can kind of pop up in a church, you know, when it's election time. We can run through your neighborhood, but we'll never see you again so long as you vote for us. And I think that's part of what a lot of black voters are pushing against in this election. They're tired of being taken for granted by the party. You know, when the election started last year, you know, we heard a lot about how this was the most diverse field in the history of American politics. And it was. But where are we now? With a group of white people, for the most part. You know, so I think that's something else. People want that representation. It's like, you can't just have my vote. I need to feel like I'm being represented by the people who you want me to elect.
Okay, just to kind of underscore what Renee is saying, I want to revisit 2016 for a second. Here is then presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking at a rally in Michigan asking for the support of black voters.
Look how much African-American communities have suffered under Democratic control. To those I say the following. What do you have to lose by trying something new like Trump?
Michael Curry goes on to say, you're living in poverty, your schools are bad, 58% youth unemployment. React to all that.
Yeah, it's funny. I would say Donald Trump, President Trump, is the master of the okey-doke, right? He likes to make you think that there is no alternative but him. But the reality is, yes, the Democratic Party has ignored, marginalized, neglected communities of color, and that's true. And we can have that be true and also look at Donald Trump's record and his rhetoric. And it's clear that whether you're a black immigrant or immigrant of color, this is not the right president for your concerns. If it's health care, this is not the right president. His policies go against everything we fought for. If you're civil rights and you understand the importance of our civil rights laws, he will undermine and is in the process of undermining them now. So I hope black voters, as the numbers have been around 8%, some polls have it even higher among black voters. The reality is most black voters understand and won't fall for the okey-doke that this president is not their nominee. But we should still hold the Democratic Party accountable for, as I often reference Sheriff Tompkins, you would often push candidates here to say, hey, don't just go through our neighborhood, set up an office in Grove Hall. Be visible. I need you to walk through our neighborhoods and talk to people on the streets and not just come for fundraisers. And I think there are folks like Sheriff Tompkins across the country that I know that are doing the same thing.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Teddy, you're on the line. Teddy from Medford. You're on the line with Michael Curry and Renee Graham. What's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to comment on something the panelists said earlier. I think Bernie Sanders has the best shot of sort of getting the most unified vote. If you look at some of the polls, it kind of seems like he does the best with self-described conservatives and independents. And even in South Carolina, where he did lose, many of the voters in the exit polls said 50% of them supported Medicare for all. So that kind of shows me that I think he has a diverse coalition. So, and he can unify the base.
So, Renee, there's Teddy answering the question that I asked to listeners, was what does that profile look like of the person who can win? What's your reaction to that?
I mean, I think he has a point. I do think that there are lots of people who like what they're hearing from the more progressive candidates. The question is that the agenda that most Americans are going to back when they go to vote? And I think that there is a people aren't certain that that's necessarily going to be the case. So, you know, look, I think in a different election, if you weren't opposing Donald Trump, I think a progressive agenda would do much better. I think people would have the sense that we can kind of take a chance and maybe go a little further to the left because we're not worried about what will happen if the nation rejects that and goes with Donald Trump. But it's because Trump is there that I think the progressive message isn't getting the traction it should get in all communities of color.
All right, I want to add another caller here because I think it's going to follow on to that. 1-800-423-8255 if you want to join the conversation. We've got Dave on from Millbury, Massachusetts. Dave, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to know why black voters would think a moderate Democrat would be able to beat Trump if Trump already beat a moderate Democrat.
Okay, great question. Michael, let me turn that over to you.
Yeah, I don't think it's that simple. I think people feel like there's a certain character type, a certain record that's necessary to beat this president. I think Joe Biden's record, I think African-American voters can increasingly look at him as a solid person on the issues. He's worked on the Affordable Care Act. He's worked on the finance issues on Wall Street, along with others, and Senator Warren. I think it's clear to America that, at least to black America, that he's a viable candidate. I've said on your show and others in the past that I think if they had another more exciting choice, Biden would not be their choice. And they would walk away like they did from Hillary Clinton for Obama. But he is I think, as many African-Americans view him, to be the most solid candidate. Now, that's weakened because he's done so poorly in debates that even the African-American vote on him is shaky. But they don't believe that Bernie Sanders has the message, the approach that's going to bring together more Americans and maybe win the middle, win those independent voters that will come over and give him a win.
So, Renee, Michael, go ahead.
I just want to be clear. I'm not painting Joe Biden as a perfect candidate by any stretch of the imagination. He has political baggage from the 1994 crime bill to Anita Hill. Those are issues that black voters certainly look at, you know, and they give Joe Biden some side eye on that because he still hasn't fully explained his actions in those circumstances. But given the current political climate, he seems like the best choice. But again, you have to remember, we're what? Two caucuses and two primaries into this thing. You know, there are still places where this can go that we aren't anticipating. Last year, this time, Joe Biden was the prohibitive favorite. He dropped off. Now he's suddenly back. I think there's still a lot of room for this race to change.
And just Bernie has a huge hill to climb. You need to think about the Alabama, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Virginia. Over 25% of the voters are African-American. If he can't get on the ground and really start to move the votes in the black community, he has a challenge. I know he skipped Selma this past week. Many of the candidates went down to Selma with Congressman Lewis to walk the Edmund Pettus Bridge. But he did go and meet with Reverend Barber of Moral Mondays in North Carolina to kind of sway him and his support. He's going to need to really get that. If he can't get the black vote, he cannot win.
Yeah. So we've talked a number of times already in this conversation sort of about polls and how black voters look like they're polling, et cetera. One of the things that's really becoming very clear is that polls statistically seem to be undercounting and underconsidering black voters. So how realistic of a picture, Renee, do we have, especially from the early primary states and early polls, of where black voters, who you have said a couple times today are not a monolith, right, are thinking and caring about in this race?
Well, I think one thing everyone should have noticed coming out of South Carolina is how different this race might be if the first two states had been Nevada and South Carolina instead of Iowa and New Hampshire. Because the wins that people were seeing, like, say, that Mayor Buttigieg was getting in New Hampshire and Iowa and also it looks like a bit of a mirage now because they did so poorly when you had a more diverse electorate. So I think there's a mistake. You know, look. People of color are going to decide the next Democratic nominee. That's a fact. You can throw all the polls out. That's the way it's going to go. And the candidate who can manage to hold on to those populations is the candidate who's going to win. If you can't do that, if you can't figure out a way to break through, then you're going to be out of the race, like Amy Klobuchar, who had dismal numbers with people of color, like Mayor Buttigieg, who had, you know, dismal numbers. You have to win that vote. That is the background of the Democratic Party. And if you don't have it, your campaign's going to fail.
Okay, so Michael, pretend I'm one of the remaining candidates who just heard what Renee said.
Yeah.
And so now I turn to you and say, understanding that there's great variation across the country, list for me the issues that I must focus on and where I need to be on those to make sure I win that vote.
Yeah, I think we're in a pretty good place with the Democratic nominees, those that are still in the race and those that were. You know, folks understand the historic time that we're in to deal with criminal justice issues, how we should be advancing the Affordable Care Act. There are still millions of uninsured people and underinsured people in America, and many of them look like me. They're black and they're brown. So I think that our candidates in general have the right message. Some are being more aspirational, Medicare for all and free access to education. The challenge is we're at the point now where people say, okay, it's about whether you can put up or shut up. Do we think that you as a candidate can beat this man, Donald Trump, when it's just the two of you head up? And I think there's a challenge with some of the candidates. I think whether there's an embedded concern among voters that a woman can beat Donald Trump, and that disturbs me when I hear women say that, but I understand it as an African-American when you say a black person. I don't think a black person can win when Obama ran. We have to get beyond that, but we're still there. And I think, quite frankly, we're operating based on a reaction to Donald Trump versus an aspiration around issues. That's where we are. All the stakes are on whether this man gets to serve an additional 4 years.
All right, I want to grab at least one more call before we run out of time. We've got Preston on the line from Cape Cod. Preston, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm listening to. I came in late, but I was just watching Public Enemy endorsing Bernie. And from the last time, if the moderates steal it away from him with super delegates and he has a majority, then whoever it is will definitely lose to Donald Trump because the progressive is so strong, they will not vote for the moderate candidate. They just won't do it.
So, Renee, this is an interesting point. Thank you, Preston. I saw you react to somebody else on Twitter this weekend who made a similar point, and you had a very strong response that was a position of privilege. Do you want to talk about that?
It is a position of privilege. If you can say, well, if Bernie doesn't win, I'm not going to vote, that means the policies of the current administration will not affect you and you do not care about the people it's going to affect. And that's a selfish attitude. And also, you know, at this point in our country, you're not just voting for a candidate. You're voting for the preservation of democracy. Because, you know, if democracy was on the ballot 4 years ago, as President Obama said, this time around, it's on the ropes. So if you are so into yourself that you feel like, well, I'm not going to bother if I don't get my candidate, then you're essentially voting for Donald Trump and the status quo. And there's nothing more establishment than voting for that.
So, Michael, you're nodding so vigorously.
This one is an important one because I think, one, there's going to be some intentionality on the right to get voters, particularly African-American voters, to not vote for anyone. I think they're going to play that up. I think whether the Russians or whoever's involved will put those messages out on social media. The reality is this, and I think this is the responsibility of organizations like the NAACP and others. We got to go to voters and say, okay, ultimately, it doesn't matter who you plan to vote for and whether they made it to be the nominee. Show up. Because we know if you show up, you'll do the right thing. Whatever the right thing is a nonpartisan organization, but we got to show up. So if you don't have a Barack Obama on the ticket in 2020, if you don't have the candidate you wanted, maybe you were supporting Bernie Sanders and he didn't become the nominee, hypothetically. We don't have it is detrimental to our communities and everything you care about that you show up and vote. And I think that message is all of our responsibility.
So, Renee, we've only got a little bit more than a minute left, but during that time, sooner or later, 2020 will be over, and it will be 2021.
Will it?
And then, yeah, good point. And Democrats will need to ask, how do we engage deeply with Black American voters over the next 4 years, regardless of this outcome? What's the mission there?
You know, I have to say a template for me, at least in this election cycle, has been Elizabeth Warren. And the way she has centered especially Black women in her campaign, whether she's been talking about education, HBCUs, infant mortality rates, that's how you do it. Now, it hasn't necessarily translated into the kind of support that I think a lot of her backers would have hoped for, but I think that's what you have to do. You have to put it in the forefront. You can't come into these issues like you just crammed for the exam and now you're just sort of regurgitating what you just read in the textbook. There has to be a sense of a deeper commitment to these issues and to these communities for it to make a difference.
Okay, and Michael, in 15 seconds or so, anything you want to add to that?
We're used to people promising things to us as a community, and many of them are Democrats, and they don't follow through, and then they put crime bills and other things in place. People are going to hold their elected officials accountable, especially as younger voters engage. And I think you have to show up and show that you're going to do these things that you say you're going to do. I'm excited because I think many of the nominees, the candidates, are speaking truth and are recognizing when they've been wrong in the past.
Okay, that's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Renee, thank you.
Thank you.
And listen, at the top of this segment, I said that the remaining candidates were all white. I need to correct myself because, in fact, Tulsi Gabbard, who was a remaining candidate, does identify as a person of color.